Not every person could make a living helping people die, but today's guest does that in his work as a hospice chaplain. And he not only finds great value in the work, he's learned a great deal while assisting people with terminal conditions. So Fred Gruey wrote a book to share what he's learned. It's called What the Dying Have Taught Me About Living. Fred Gruey is a board-certified chaplain and United Church of Christ minister working for Providence Hospice in Medford. The voice comes in handy for the ministry, and he reveals in the book that he was also a disc jockey in college. Fred joined us for a shorter discussion in March of this year. Glad to have you back for a full hour, Fred Gruey.
Jeffrey, it's a privilege. Thank you.
This goes back quite a while in your life. You point out in the book that you cared for your dying mother at age 22.
I'll tell you a funny story and then a more. My mom died at 44 after a seven-year battle of breast cancer. And back in the 70s, you know, it was the double mastectomy, and then it went to her uterus, so the hysterectomy, and then it went into her bones. And so she spent the last year of her life on the couch of our family room. And I had just graduated college and moved home. And I, you know, 22, a boy's brain isn't even fully developed at that. You know, I was dumber than dirt. And it was difficult. The thing I remember, it was hard, but it wasn't bad. I mean, helping to care for my mother was, it brought a kindness and a depth out of me I didn't know I had. And I remember one night, you know, I was laying on the floor of the family room watching TV. She was on the couch, and she had wooden crutches at that point and it was hard to move around. And she goes, "You want some ice cream?" I said, "Yeah, right." And about a half hour later, she gets up off the couch with the crutches, goes up seven stairs into the rest of the house. And about 20 minutes later, she's coming back with a stupid bowl of ice cream and a spoon, balancing it with the wooden crutches, coming down the seven stairs. I said, "What are you doing?" And I thought she had gone to the bathroom. I mean, I had forgotten. And she said, "Look, I want to be your mom." And moments like that were just so rich. And it was hard, but it was beautiful. And maybe the greatest gift my mother gave me was teaching me that I had this kindness and strength in me that I didn't know was in there. Well, anyway, fast forward. So I'm studying to be a chaplain. This is about 10 years ago. I'm in the 60s. I'm 62 now. So, you know, I was in my 50s. So it's 30-some years since my mother's passed away. So I'm on the floor of this hospital in St. Louis where I'm doing my residency training. And I walk in a room, and there's a lady that's just been told she has breast cancer. And her husband is sitting there looking out a window. The lights are off in the room. And instantly, I'm transported 35 years back, and I'm with my mother. And I burst into tears. So here's a woman that's just been told she's got breast cancer. The chaplain comes walking in the room and bursts into tears. And she had to comfort me. But we had a wonderful discussion, and I told her the story of my mom, and she asked me to come back. And so, you know, this stuff gets into us, and it doesn't get out. It just sort of hovers around in there in moments it erupts, and when it does, it does.
You mentioned having a fear about death.
Yeah.
You were not at ease with the concept of
no.
death. And for how, if it, was there a particular incident? Was it
your
mother's death?
No. I think it was the unknown. I grew up, I never wanted to touch anything dead. I mean, it just freaked me out because I didn't understand it. But I think, you know, going through things with my mom, and then, you know, the other big story in the book is my friend that died of AIDS. Being with the two of them, like I say, was hard. But being with them and going through that, I became the best person I was. It's like going through those difficult things with people that I loved brought the kind of me out of me that I wanted to be. And so it just got me to reevaluate the whole thinking, and it's why I've become a hospice chaplain.
You point out that you generally do not tell people what you do for a living
right
when you meet them. Why?
Oh, come. Because as soon as you say, "Hi, I'm Fred, I'm a hospice chaplain," it either shuts the conversation down or people tilt their head knowingly and give you big doe eyes and look at you like your brother Teresa, and I am not. They think it's this, no, what a self-sacrificing, noble person. I'm not. It is. I was telling you, you know, when we were listening to the weather, it's the greatest gig you could have as a minister. I mean, I get to have really serious conversations with people about the stuff that really, when you're a pastor, and that's a hard job. Oh God. And I was a pastor and I was a horrible one. People lie to pastors all the time, you know, like, or the nonsense you have to put up with. People will say that, you know, someone was sitting in our pew on Sunday, or, you know, why do we sing the same songs every week? Or, you know, if you just preach 10 minutes quicker, we could get out of here and beat the Baptist to all the good restaurants. I mean, that's the nonsense pastors have. I don't hear any of that. By the time I meet folks, so much of the nonsense has been kicked out of them either by the pain, a diagnosis, the medication. They're just, and so you get to really have rich, meaningful, what, Jeffrey, it's like time stands still. And you just get to be human with another person. And what they share of what they've learned in life is so rich. And it's just beautiful. And I get to do this. I mean, it's crazy.
You mentioned that concept of time standing still in the book. It just you just kind of hang in the moment there. It's just that time, that place.
For several reasons. A lot of the folks I meet suffer from some kind of dementia. And so all that is the present. There is no past and there is no future. So you're forced to that. But for the other folks, it's so important. It's so rich. It's so vibrant. Nothing really else matters.
Fred Gruey is our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. His book, What the Dying Have Taught Me About Living, and his work as a hospice chaplain. We'll come back and talk more with Fred. And you can join the conversation as well. We'll take your phone calls and emails when we return with Fred Gruey to the Jefferson Exchange in a minute 15. Back on the Jefferson Exchange on the News and Information Service of Jefferson Public Radio. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thanks for listening. Our guest today is Fred Gruey, a board-certified chaplain, United Church of Christ minister, who's working for Providence Hospice in Medford as a hospice chaplain. So he counsels a lot of people in the final moments of their lives, and he's written a book about his experiences, What the Dying Have Taught Me About Living, The Awful Amazing Grace of God. You can join Fred and me as we talk about this on the Exchange, 800-838-3760. Around the region, 800-838-3760, or by email jx@jeffnet.org. Curious about your own religious experiences. What got you into, I mean, not just the hospice part of it, but just being a minister in the first place. It sounds like early in life, the learning of the concept of heaven and hell shook you up.
Yeah. My first memory of it was walking down the sidewalk from my grandmother's house. And the way it's presented, it's scary. There's this good place, and if you behave, you get to go there. And if you're bad, you're going to be on fire in torment forever and ever. Well, yeah, that's terrifying. And when you're 5 or 6 or when you're 60 or 70. I mean,
By the time you get to college, though, the relationship had changed just a bit. And the way you describe it, it is sort of sound like hanging out with Jesus is the way it ended up for you, because you just sort of went to a place and Jesus was there with you.
My life was interrupted. I was just a fat, neurotic, sexually naive young Catholic kid, ended up on a retreat because I was told there'd be girls there. And in the middle, I was bored, hated it. And in the middle of it, I went into the chapel by myself. And all of a sudden, I just knew Jesus was alive and loved me. And that moment, November 21st, 1971, about 12 noon Eastern time, changed my life. I mean, it was radical. The universe shifted for me in that instant, in that moment. And then over the course of the year, I mean, I talk about the tragic thing is from that incredible experience. For me, you know, Jeffrey, the really important thing was I felt accepted. I had so much struggled for acceptance so much of my life because I was always fat and I was always, you know, felt like an outsider and inferior. And I felt accepted by God. And that was huge. But then I became this Pentecostal preacher that really proclaimed a message of you'll be accepted if you do it my way, which was not what I had experienced. And that was really somewhat tragic. And fortunately, as I talk about in the book, awful grace beat that out of me. And I'm more of a more open, tolerant, liberated person.
I want to get to the concept of awful grace. Yeah. It was obviously part of the subtitle of the book. But I do want to talk as well about the other person you mentioned, because you mentioned you're nursing your mother to her death at age 22. Your age 22, she was 44.
Right.
But you mentioned your friend who died of AIDS, Petey.
Yeah.
This was a big blow in your life.
Huge, huge. Yeah, he was. I was a Pentecostal or charismatic minister starting a church, and he was a dear friend. In the same church system, they lived about 3 hours from us, and just dear, dear friends. He was like a brother I never had, and he was sick in the hospital. When he got out, we went down to celebrate with his family. He was married and had 3 teenage kids, and our wives went out shopping for the feast, and we're sitting in his kitchen, and he just looks at me and says, "I got something to tell you." I said, "What?" And he said, "I got AIDS," and oh my God, Jeffrey, it was one of those moments. Time just absolutely stood still. I was devastated. I was confused. In a nanosecond, so many things flooded through me. Here was this man that I loved that I knew was going to die, because in the early 90s, that was a horrible death sentence. The thought of him, when then he told me that he had a hidden life as a homosexual, and so here was this Pentecostal man that, you know, was my brother, had this hidden life, and, you know, just images of him and other guys flashed into my head, and that kind of freaked me out. And I didn't know what to say or what to do. I was ill-prepared in that moment. But somehow in that, like what we were talking about a moment ago, the grace of Jesus somehow came on me. I got up off my stool, walked over, kissed him on the cheek, said, "You're my brother, and we'll deal with this." And we just cried, and I was shocked. I mean, I was amazed. I didn't know what to do, but I just knew this was a man I loved. How could I didn't understand it. And that sort of began about a 10-year process of deconstructing some theological structures that I had crafted that really weren't helpful.
And you do range far and wide finding purpose in grief, and I'm sure in other parts of your religious education and ministry.
Yeah.
But the for example, you have St. Francis, Buddhists, and Native Americans in one paragraph in the book.
Oh, yeah. Look, anywhere I can get wisdom, I need all the help I can get, brother. So, you know, if it's the Buddha, if it's Francis, anybody. I mean, I'm looking. I think for me, the best of religion helps us to become more compassionate to other human beings. Look, bottom line, I had a patient earlier this summer that asked me, sometimes when I visit folks, they're bored and they're tired of just laying in a bed waiting to die, and they want a vacation from the dying process, and so they want entertainment, and that's what they want me to come for. And so they'll ask me about my life, what's going on. And so this one lady was in a nursing home, and she goes, "So what's happening in your life?" I said, "Well, I wrote a book, and they published." She goes, "What's a book?" And I told her what the dying have taught me about living. And she looked at me and says, "So what'd they teach you?" And so I sort of blurted out, surrender to reality, shower the people you love with love. And I forget the first point I said to her. But that's really what it boils down to. How can we become more compassionate to the people in our lives? Because at the end, Jeffrey, all these people that I meet, that's what really matters.
Fred Grew is our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. His book is What the Dying Have Taught Me About Living, The Awful Amazing Grace of God. You can join this discussion on the Jefferson Exchange. Our phone number, 800-838-3760. Anywhere you can hear us, 800-838-3760. Email address is jx@jeffnet.org. You describe being called to the ER for a baby's death. How even start what you do in the midst of such awful emotion, such powerful emotion in an awful circumstance?
That was an awful night. I was in there 4 hours. I had just gotten home, and the hospital called me to come back in, and that's never a good thing. When I got there, it was a young couple, and their baby had died at home, and they brought the baby into the ER. And part of what, Jeffrey, what makes this so awful in the day we live in, the culture, the folks are often treated as criminals until the coroner can get there to determine this wasn't a caused death. So the ER becomes a crime scene. The parents are cordoned off. They're not allowed to be, well, I'm sorry, I keep kicking this thing. They're not allowed to sort of be in the room, and they're treated with sort of suspicion. And so here you've got this young couple, you know, in their late teens, early 20s, their first child who has died, and they're grieving. And then there's all this other layers of stuff going on until the coroner can come and make a determination on the cause of death. So it's just awful. And what I have found in places like that, words are useless, because words are just tools that we have to communicate from one soul to another, and they're coded sounds. And it requires having a mind that can decode the sounds. And when you're in that kind of grief, you can't decode the sounds. And so words just are futile. You just try and be as kind as you can be with your bodily actions, with your facial expression, with the tone of your voice, with your silence. You're trying to bring comfort until everything can get resolved. And fortunately, that night, the coroner did show up. And then we learned later that the baby, even born, had had heart problems and had been taken to Portland for specialists, but we didn't have that information right at the beginning. So it all got no one had done anything wrong at all. But it was just, I went home that night and I was just emotional. I mean, just to be in the presence, in the room of that kind of deep grief, it sucks the life energy. And I know we're in Ashland, I'm not trying to be ooey ooey, but it does just pull all the life energy out of you to be in that. It's like a black hole of emotions just sucking the energy out of you. And it is hard and it is awful and words are useless.
How then do you continue to do this day after day? I mean, granted, not all the situations are nearly as emotionally charged as that one, but you're still talking about dealing with the death of a human being, which is always sad to other human beings. What do you do to keep yourself in the process without getting knocked down by it, flattened out, like, sorry, I can't come to work today?
Well, a couple of things. First of all, as a chaplain for Providence Hospice, most of the folks here in the Rogue Valley that I visit that are passing or dying are well into their 70s, 80s, 90s. So we're not infants. That's really an unusual and rare thing, thank God. So most of the folks have at least had a good run at life, whether they lived it well or not. At least they've had a run. So that makes it different. But for me, it's mentally, two things help. I personally believe, and I never foist this on anyone, but I personally believe that whatever happens next is really good, just because of the grace I've experienced, the rascal that I am in this life. But but secondly, I realize many of the folks I meet, it's the worst time of their life. They're going through the hardest thing they ever have. So it's like, I can't mess up. I can help make the worst moment a little better. And I find great comfort. That's meaningful for me, that in the hardest time of someone's life, I can be there to be kind and to make it a little better. That's important. But I also do my own self-nurturing, my own prayer, my meditation, my connection to God as I understand God. That's really important. But it is this thought, I can't mess up. It's already as bad as it can get. I can only help it be a little better.
the awful grace now, the awful grace of God. And as you point out, Bobby Kennedy made the phrase famous, but it's got a much longer history than from 1968.
Yeah, Aeschylus, the father of dramatic theater. I got to find the quote because I'll butcher it if I don't say it right. And it's too beautiful to mess up. But Aeschylus, about 2,800 years ago, in the very first dramatic, tragic play called Agamemnon, has the chorus ask this rhetorical question. Oh, Jeffrey, where the heck is it?
Didn't bookmark it for you, sorry.
No, I know. So I'll stumble. But the rhetorical question is, can a human being become wise without suffering? And Aeschylus writes this incredible line that I'll butcher because I can't find it in the book. I should memorize. He who learns must suffer. And even in our sleep, pain that cannot forget falls drop by drop upon the heart. And against our will comes wisdom to us by the awful grace of God. And oh, man, when I read that, it got me thinking how, as I've reflected on my own life, how some of the darkest moments, some of the hardest moments gave birth to the richest me. And I think that's what Aeschylus is talking about. And I would add the word compassionate. I don't think any of us can become truly wise or compassionate without going through suffering. Now, here's the problem, though. Suffering can make us mean and bitter. It's not a guarantee. You suffer, you'll become wise and compassionate. Suffered tongue sometimes just makes people mean as rattlesnakes. And so that's why the word grace is important to me. There's this something that comes to help like an alchemist, transform this difficult thing, this experience, to something that can become rich and beautiful. And so I want to, when it is transformed by grace, I want to celebrate that. But I also want to be very careful not to make someone feel like a spiritual mutant if it doesn't occur. I don't want them to feel inferior because it didn't happen for them in that moment. So that's the line you try to walk.
Fred Gruey, again, our guest on the Jefferson Exchange, a chaplain with Providence Hospice in Medford. He's written a book called What the Dying Have Taught Me About Living. There's a great term you use in the book, emotional cleanup, where the doctor delivers the news of the pending death, and then you have to go in and help the family and the patient through this.
Yeah, at medical school, they really don't teach a lot of touchy-feely skills. And so the doctors come in and sort of drop what they call the bomb. And in my thinking, if you're thinking of it, I have to come in and drop the bomb. Whatever I say, it's not going to go well, if that's what you
think. If you're expecting devastation.
Yes. So most of chaplain training, Jeffrey, is really hard. It's a lot harder than being a disc jockey when I was a disc jockey. Chaplain training is at least 5 years. And basically what they do is they beat the nonsense out of you, because you just can't fix really anything. And so the basic thing of being a chaplain is just shut up, sit there, and don't run away. And so you let people, and my short definition of what does a chaplain do, a chaplain helps to create a safe place for people to go crazy. Because when you've just been told you're going to die, what are you supposed to do? How are you supposed to? So we just want to help create a safe place to go ahead and freak out, but don't hurt yourself or anybody else. That's what we try to do.
What do you do when people then are overcome, though, with grief and rage and whatever else? I mean, so the safe place, so you have to give them room to do this. I mean, do you try to soothe them, get you shush them a little bit or anything like that?
No, never. Sometimes I'll scream with them and cry. I mean, and you can't plan that, but oftentimes I end up crying right with the folks, because it's you're in that emotion. I'm human. I feel that, what they're feeling, and words are, like I was saying earlier, words in those moments are useless, because we can't process correctly and decode those. And so I just feel with the people, realizing, look, this will pass, and you know, balance is going to come back at some point, but you got to let it. The only way through grief, you can't go around it. You just go through, and you surrender to it when it's there. I just want to make sure they don't say something hurtful to someone they love, And that I will try now. I'll try and walk them off the ledge on that or do something hurtful to themselves. I don't want that. But you got to feel what you feel.
So you're there at several stages, it sounds like when the news is delivered right up to the actual end of life?
It varies, and it's unique case to case. But more and more, in the way the medical field is working, palliative care is becoming a big thing, and I'm sure you're aware of that. And so a lot of times the news is broken in a palliative meeting, and at Providence there's always a chaplain present for a palliative consult where the news is given. So by the time I meet folks on hospice, the news has already been given to them. My work, more in my training when I was at St. Louis University Hospital, I was always there when the news was given. So it's a different setting.
All right, much more to talk about with Fred Gruey, the pastor, the Providence Hospice chaplain. His book is What the Dying Have Taught Me About Living. We'll talk more with Fred and take phone calls and emails as well when we return to the Jefferson Exchange in a minute 30. Final segment on today's Jefferson Exchange. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. Our guest today is Fred Gruey. He is a chaplain with Providence Hospice in Medford, so he is at the bedside of people on their way to and often very close to death, and the family members as well. He's written a book about his experiences called What the Dying Have Taught Me About Living, The Awful, Amazing Grace of God. This is a conversation you're more than welcome to join. Our phone number, 800-838-3760 throughout the listening area, 800-838-3760, or send emails to jx@jeffnet.org. Here's a call from Pam in Dexter. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange.
Hi. Well, a lot of what you're saying really resonates with me. I find it interesting that our culture avoids talking about death and facing the inevitable. And I had heard once that every death prepares you a little more for your own, and I really think that's true. So recently, a good friend of mine died. She had pancreatic cancer, and she chose to do physician-assisted suicide, and it was she was such a classy, wonderful, loving, talented, intelligent woman. But the day before she chose to die, she came to the farmer's market, which she helped us with, and had played putt-putt golf with her grandchildren and had a dinner and said, well, tomorrow's the day. And it was just kind of a very unusual way to talk with someone. But she was an atheist, and I didn't know how to... I mean, I had lived in a haunted house for 2 years, so I told her, you know what? There's things out there that we don't know, and I hope you're wrong. And we kind of joked around. I said, well, if you can come back as a ghost... And, you know, I just wonder how you approach people who are atheists and facing their death, because for her it was like, when you're dead, that's it, it's over. And I don't know, I want to be more hopeful than that. And because of my experience of living in this house with other realities, we talked about quantum physics and that possibility of other dimensions. And I just wonder how you approach atheists. And thanks for all your work. I think it's really important for us to walk this walk together and end in a graceful and loving way.
All right, Pam, thanks for the call. Very much appreciate it.
Yeah, Pam, thanks for the kind words. So with atheists, one of the hospice nurses that I work with get a big kick out of it. They laugh and giggle that the atheists and agnostics are often the patients that love me the most. And part of the thing is, I think, when I meet folks, I don't try to talk anybody out of whatever it is they believe, because in a sense that would be very patronizing. You know, well, you shouldn't believe what you should believe. You should believe what I believe, you know.
Yeah, you've lived this long, and here in your final hours, I'm going to disabuse you of that notion.
And so they relax quite a bit as soon as they find out I'm not going to try and talk them out of anything, and I really want to learn what they think and why they think it and how they do. And then the conversation really becomes just a sharing and often rich. Although one of the atheists, I have to say, I really and they know I love him. Well, I did the funeral. In fact, I just on my blog page, if I could do a plug, fredgrewe.com.
G-R-E-W-E.
Yeah, G-R-E-W-E. In fact, this week's, I didn't even realize this. What a great question. I talk about one of my dearest friends that passed away that was an atheist that went to the Presbyterian Church because he liked to sing and he wanted to be in the choir. But he was an atheist. And we were dear friends and he taught me quite a bit. And so acceptance and love is experienced. And whether you're an atheist or a Christian or a Buddhist, those are good things. And I realize as an agent of religion, which is what I am, my goal, everything I've ever experienced from God has been acceptance. So I want to offer that to everybody I meet, regardless of their faith or not faith. But one other atheist story I want to tell you, another guy I really liked a lot who was an atheist, was a philosophy teacher. He had graduated, I believe, from Harvard. So we're talking a really bright man who was absolutely convinced that when we die, that's it. We cease to exist and it's all over. That was his life philosophy. And he longed for that. He was elderly. He couldn't, his autonomy was gone. He couldn't go where he wanted and do what he wanted anymore. He was just tired, ready to not exist. He was so looking forward to it. And about a week or two before he passed, his mother and father started to appear to him. Now, this is a very common thing in mm-hmm. hospice work. And every week I have people tell me they see deceased loved ones that no one else can see. And it never scares anybody. In fact, doctors used to call them hallucinations. They don't anymore because so many studies have been done. These experiences cross culture, gender, economic class. So they don't call them hallucinations. They don't know what to call them.
Anywhere in the world, anybody in the world.
And it's always loved ones. It's never frightening. And they're so common and specific. But for this man, it was frightening because it made him reevaluate. What if there is something? Because he had planned to not exist and he wanted to not exist. So his mom and dad showed up. And in one hand, it was comforting, but another, it made him reevaluate some things. But look, I think if we can create as a loving, kind environment to exit from, that's as good as we can do. And I know everybody has, or many people, I should say, have very strong opinions about what happens next. And I have strong opinions about what happens next, but they're just opinions. None of us knows. And so I hold it lightly. For me, as a Christian, as a minister, as a chaplain, what I try to do is I want to passionately believe what I believe and live that out and hold it all lightly because the way I understand it, I could be wrong. And I want to try to do both. I don't want to be a milquetoast. I don't want to just, well, whatever. I want to passionately give myself to something, but also be open to learn and grow.
That's an unusual thing for a person of strong faith, is, you know, entertaining the possibility that maybe you don't have the story quite right.
Well, like I told you during the last break, there's 37, at last count, there's 37,000 Christian denominations, all using the same book, saying, follow us, we know the way. Well, how are you supposed to pick between 37,000?
Fred Grewe, again, our guest on The Exchange. His book is What the Dying Have Taught Me About Living. There's a chapter in here I can't say the name of and managed to keep our license on the radio. So let's say Jack Squat.
There you go.
So it's about a guy named Jack. What was Jack's issue?
Oh, well, that's a complex thing. Jack, I was in his house. He was a very fundamentalist Christian, wonderful, looked like Eeyore, tall, lanky guy. But he was so depressed that you just loved him. You just wanted to hold him. It was like, so I went in his house 5 minutes and he goes, well, God could never forgive me. And I said, well, can I get your autograph? And he looked, what do you want? I said, well, it's very rare that I meet someone that claims to be more powerful than God. And he goes, what do you mean? I said, well, if I understand you right, you just told me your ability to sin is greater than God's ability to forgive. You're powerful, man. I want your autograph. And he laughed, and we became friends. But as I learned, you know, he never did tell me whatever the great, deep, dark secret issue was, and not important that I know. But I learned he had a father that he really loved, but his father told an uncle on the father's deathbed that this man that I was seeing, Jack, was the greatest disappointment in his father's life. And so, and his father had been a football player of note and had run around on his Jack's mother with many different women. So, and so Jack had this father that he could never appease or live up to. And he also had a God that he couldn't appease or live up to. And so what was Jack's issue? I don't know. But somehow, over the course of the months together, Jack really made peace with all that stuff. And before he left, he really felt that he had been forgiven. And whether that was with his own pastor or just his own prayer or some, I don't know. But he really did. And I'm very glad because he was a very kind man.
In addition to the chapter that we're euphemistically calling Jack Squat, I mean, the fact is you do talk about BS in the book, which we will not spell out here on the radio as well. But there's a real sense of it not being there at the end, that there's really no point in pretension. And in fact, come to think of it, we had Debbie Zaslow in here last week talking about bringing Bubby home. About the fact that in some cases you're dealing with the true essence of a person because they can't remember the pretenses and the artifices of the past and the guises they had to keep up. And you at the last part of life are the lucky guy in a sense because you're getting the real person.
The filters are eaten away by pain, medications, or just facing, you know, the existential loss of meaning. So who gives a risk? There's no need for the filters anymore. And I like that. I mean, I enjoy being in that. But once again, I realize, Jeffrey, I'm in there for maybe a half hour to an hour on a visit. So it's not like I'm there 24/7, you know, dealing. So I get windows, which I'm sort of wired to deal with pretty well.
Let us take another call. We have John and Eugene on the line. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with Fred Gruey. What the Dying Have Taught Me About Living is his book.
Hi, this may not be an appropriate question because you are not putting your religious faith on other people. But when my mom was dying, and it was because you brought up the mom story, it kind of brought me back to that time. We had a lot of religious people in the neighborhood who were really insistent that she reconsider her long-held non-beliefs.
Yeah.
And we had trouble figuring out how to deal with them. You know, we didn't want to be impolite, but it was like, look, she's the one who's dying. So I thought maybe I'd get your comment, and I should just mention, too, that rattlesnakes aren't mean. It's just the way rattlesnakes are.
I wondered if somebody's going to call him on that. So thanks for that, John. Good to hear from you.
Thanks. Yeah, John, look, as a chaplain, I get that quite a bit. I would say certainly several times a month I'll have a distraught family member or friend call me, desperate to get their loved ones saved before they pass. And it's just hard, you know, it's just hard because you try to be nice. You know, people are experiencing grief and they have their strong belief system. But so you just, John, all I can say, I try to be as kind to everybody as I can, but I'm certainly not going to push something on anybody. The last thing I want to do is make anybody feel shamed or guilty or because, honestly, God has never made me feel that way, and I don't want to lay that trip on somebody else. So
there is the term deathbed conversions that exists in our culture, and it's actually often used about political situations, it seems, more than real life these days. But do people ever decide they want to reach out and change their religious traditions in the final days, final hours?
It does, and I think, quite honestly, it's not the times I've experienced it. And just to give you some context, I've been doing this about 10 years, and I've been with about 1,000 folks. So this isn't a study that I can point to of all different things. But normally when I experience those kinds of things, it's to appease others or it's like fire insurance so that I'm not going to burn forever in this place of eternal torment. So rather than being called by a deep love, and in fact, my favorite writer is a guy named Brennan Manning, who used to call the phrase that evangelicals use today, being saved or born again, 150, 200 years ago in the South, what that was referred to as, have you been seized by the great affection? And I like that. So if someone is called by this deep love and acceptance, that for me is genuine, authentic. For somebody that's just terrified and afraid and trying to do something to get out of trouble, that one's tougher for me.
Yeah, I noticed that in some of the stories you tell in the book, you've met people certainly at their houses a lot, like Billy, the guy who lives in an old tavern.
Yeah.
So you're traveling spiritually and physically as well.
Yeah, yeah. I drive all over Josephine and Jackson County. Yeah, which is great. So I, in the car, you know, I get to recharge in between visits. So yeah, I visit folks where they live.
Is there a time in the process when you're usually there, like when they, I mean, because you've mentioned being there from when they first find out there's a terminal illness to right up to the end. I mean, are you typically there for a little while in the middle or what?
In the middle of what?
Of the process, of the dying process, or you do visit them over and over again?
Yeah. Oh no, I'll do visits as much as they want. The balance I try to do is be available but not pushy. Because there's other people that they know, have known and loved throughout their whole life that they want to spend time. I don't want to steal energy from a dying person's time with their loved ones. But if I can be of support or help, I certainly want to be there. So that's the best. So some folks I visit once a week. Some folks I visit once a month. Some folks, they meet me once, don't want me to come back. So it's totally up to them. And I just try to serve wherever they're at.
Do you think the 30-year-old you would have said, what? I'll never do that.
Absolutely. I would have never dreamed I'd be doing this in a million years.
Well, you're doing it and loving it. The book is What the Dying Have Taught Me About Living, The Awful, Amazing Grace of God. Fred Gruey, its author, our guest. Fred, thanks so much for joining us today in The Exchange.
Thank you, Jeffrey.